Learnerd Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnerd Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnerd Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for August 17th, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. And later this half hour, we'll have energy analysis with Mike Barwinski of Louis Dreyfus in Kansas City. Also, we'll have crop progress from key states in the Corn Belt, as well as a look at soybean weather heading into the crucial pod filling phase. It's all on the Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Here's how prices settled this Tuesday afternoon in Kansas City and Chicago. September wheat in Kansas City settled at 677, down 11. December at 691 and 3/4, down 11 and a quarter. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade settled at 651, down 12 and 3/4. December 683 and 3/4, down 12 and a half. September corn settled at 414 and 3/4, up 7 and a half. December 430, up 7 and a quarter. March 443 and a half, up 7 and a quarter. July 457, up 7 and 3/4. September soybeans settled at 1045 and a quarter, up 11 and a quarter. November 1042, up 10 and a half. January 1048 and a half, up 10 and 3/4. Go out to May 1048 and a quarter, up 11 and 1/4. September soybean meal settled at 306.50, up 4.30. September soybean oil settled at 41.59, up 14. August live cattle settled at 95.62 and a half, up 50. August feeders 113.25, up 55. Ock lean hogs 75.52 and a half, up 67 and a half on the day.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Here's a look at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights. He says warming will begin late this week and last through most of next week. Highs in the upper 70s and 80s will finish out this week with a few lower 90s in the far south. Highs next week will be in the 80s and lower to a few middle 90s. Rain will be lacking in the lower and eastern Midwest during much of the coming 2 weeks. Showers from Missouri and Iowa will fall apart when trying to move east of the Mississippi River tonight and Wednesday. The next best rain event for central and eastern Midwestern regions likely will be Friday into Saturday, but coverage may only be 65%, and rainfall will rarely get to 1/2 of an inch. Computer forecast models leave the lower Midwest dry through the end of August, but Drew says it is probably too dry a forecast. Upper Midwest rainfall will occur frequently to maintain good crop conditions from the eastern Dakotas and Nebraska to Wisconsin.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Well, good afternoon, Dave.
Well, what did you make overall of how the market reacted today to whatever news it gathered?
Well, I think, you know, we looked at a couple things. First, we started off with the early overnight setback in the corn and beans, and then coming on a little later as the evening closed up, we saw the crop tour with Pro Farmer finding the corn yields not quite up to last year's, but still above the average. But the bean pod counts continue to stay strong along the way. We saw an article pop out today about noon from the Dow Jones Newswires about the sudden death syndrome. The headline says, "Toast Iowa Soybean Crop." So, all of that thrown together with a little bit lower bias towards the wheat, why we've got the traders worried about the bean or the corn harvest and whether there's the variability of the stands and what's going on out here, whether we can come up to that 165 number that the government put out last week. So we saw a couple of the large advisory firms lower their estimate below that this morning on their news wires. So I think that's where the strength come from in the corn. And, the beans continuing to see the weather forecast that you just read there telling us that there's going to be the southern part of Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky there that doesn't get a lot of rain here over the next week, and we might see some decreases in yields there.
So when you take all that in hand and think that Pro Farmer is coming through what has been reported to be the worst areas in the corn growing area, parts of southern Illinois, southern Indiana, parts of Iowa, and those numbers come out later today and be thought about this evening and then by the trade tomorrow. Do you think when it's all said and done by the end of the week, Wayne, prices will have higher weekly highs?
You know, we're pushing up against some real resistance, especially in the beans. We'd need to take out that 1048 in the November beans, close above 1051 really to push on through there. That could prove to be hard. We'll have to see how the funds continue to buy that way. The Deese corn, basically along the same ideas, has to come up and take out that 438. So, will we close up and push through those marks? Why, we're going to have to wait and see a little bit how the tour and what their findings are this evening.
He's going to have to do it without the help of wheat, I would think.
Wheat is not the strong suit right now. We are seeing that I think there's a few of the countries, Egypt and a couple of the others, have said they're not in a rush to add back in, that they did secure enough French wheat there that they didn't feel that they needed to be bolstering their purchases here in the near future.
Well, it couldn't have been good for U.S. exporters of wheat to hear that news.
Well, that's why we set back a little bit today. But, we've said all along it isn't really the wheat in trouble for this year's crop. It's how the wheat plantings progress in Russia and what happens over the next year. It's more a fear for what's happening next year and more of an overflow as to what's going into, hopefully, the U.S. corn market that was using wheat for feed.
There's going to be corn harvested right quick, especially down south, although I'm actually heard a day or two ago that some corn in Illinois has already been harvested. So corn harvest is coming on. Will we see the kind of pressures in the harvest on futures that we've seen in previous years?
I don't think we will early, Dave. I mean, we talked about that last night's meeting in New Ross. I believe that the elevators, the merchandisers, are greatly looking forward to some new high-quality new crop corn to blend with some of the lower quality corn that they have left from last year. And I think that we're going to see a real aggressive or very welcome, we'll be welcoming with open arms some new crop corn to come in here as soon as possible to try to keep the pipeline full and maybe supply some of these corn needs to some of these other countries.
Well, if my bins are empty on my farm, what do I put in them?
What do you put in them? Well, if the early prices are tremendously good, or if you have sales made that you'd like to get out and put on them while the lines are short, I think we go to the elevator with our early harvest.
Of all kinds, corn, beans?
Corn and beans, both, yes, Dave.
Both go to the elevator early, and then later on we'll see, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, you know, we all have some contracts out there to use. If there are not early premiums, we can fill some of those contracts, and then we, when everybody else is waiting in line, why we can more than happily go to our own little bins and only wait on ourselves.
What kind of option strategies have you been thinking about recently that might bring a few extra dollars to producers?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on whether you're a net buyer, net seller, is the way things go, Dave. If you are a user, why we're buying a call, selling a higher price call, and selling puts below the market somewhere around the even money for feed usage. If we are just a producer and we feel that you maybe have some contracts that you feel that this market can explode, you know, we would probably be looking at some bull call spreads.
Anything else before we let you go today?
That's about it for today, Dave.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. And Wayne joins us every Tuesday afternoon here on the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Rob O'Malley in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The Pro Farmer Tour is in full swing. Yesterday, scouts on the first day of the tour checked 52 cornfields in southeastern South Dakota, where the bulk of the state's corn and soybeans are grown. The tour projected an average corn yield for the state of 143.59 bushels per acre, down from 146.96 in 2009, but above the tour's three-year average of 135.33. USDA last week forecast South Dakota's corn crop at 148 bushels to the acre, down from 151 in 2009. The average soybean pod count for South Dakota based on 52 fields was 1,262 pods, up 28.6% from the 2009 average of 982 pods and above the three-year average of 970. The eastern leg of the Pro Farmer Tour was in Ohio, where it pegged the corn crop at 165.60 bushels per acre, up from last year's crop tour average of 159.73 and the three-year tour average of 150.93 bushels to the acre. The tour's average corn yield for Ohio was nearly 7% lower than the 176 bushels per acre forecast last week by USDA. The average soybean pod count in Ohio was pegged at 1,200 pods, down 5.3% from last year, but nearly even with the three-year tour average of 1,199 pods. Yesterday afternoon, after the closing bell, NASS released its latest crop progress report for the week ending August 15th. 38% of the corn crop is in dough stage versus 52% last week. 9% of the corn crop is dented versus the five-year rolling average of 22%. Crop conditions for corn, 3% very poor, 8% poor, 20% fair, 69% good to excellent versus 71% a week ago. 92% of the soybean crop is blooming, 69% is setting pods. Crop conditions for soybeans, 3% very poor, 8% poor, 23% fair, and 66% good to excellent. That's unchanged from a week ago. Here are the crop progress reports from key states in the Corn Belt.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NASS Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending August 15, 2010. Overall, spring wheat harvest was 75% complete, 67 percentage points ahead of last year, and 33 points ahead of the five-year average. Hot, humid conditions prevailed over much of central and southern Minnesota for much of last week. The warm, wet air triggered thunderstorms across the state, with rainfall totals for the week exceeding 3 inches in some locations. Cooler, dry conditions developed across most of the state Saturday, and by Sunday, daytime highs were generally in the low to mid-70s statewide. Topsoil moisture supplies were rated 81% adequate and 71% surplus. 21% of the year's corn crop reached the milk stage during the week, pushing overall progress to 92%, 42 points ahead of last year and 13 points ahead of average. 54% of the corn was in the dough stage, and 7% was denting, both ahead of last year's pace. Statewide, 49% of the corn was reported in good condition, and 41% was in excellent condition. Pod setting was evident in 92% of this year's soybean crop, 23 points ahead of last year and 4 points ahead of the average. Statewide, 54% of the soybean crop was rated in good condition, and 34% was in excellent condition. Producers continue to monitor soybean aphid populations. That's the weekly crop weather report for the week ending August 15, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending August 15, 2010. High heat and humid conditions covered the state, aiding in the maturity of crops. Irrigation was active as soil moisture levels fell with little rainfall. Ground that will be sown to wheat in the panhandle was being prepared. Hay harvest advanced with the dry conditions. Irrigated corn conditions rated 85%, good or excellent, near the 82 of last year, while dryland corn rated 82%, above last year's 78. Corn in the dough stage was 80%, ahead of 62 last year and 72 average. Corn in the dent stage was 32%, well ahead of last year's 11 and 24 average. Soybean setting pods were at 92%, ahead of last year and the average. Sorghum headed was at 91%, with 11% of the fields turning color. Dry bean setting pods were at 84%. The third cutting of alfalfa was at 69%, ahead of last year's 55 and 60 average. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending August 15th. Hot and dry conditions continued over much of the state last week, with temperatures averaging more than 8 degrees above normal. Precipitation was also above normal in most areas and averaged 1.7 inches. This was 0.08 of an inch above normal for the week. There were 5.5 days suitable for field work around the state, and soil moisture was rated 8% very short, 20% short, 62% adequate, and 10% surplus. Growing degree day units since May 1 reached 2,435, which was 5% above normal. Around the state, 89% of corn has reached the dough stage or beyond, compared to 44% last year and 73% for the five-year average. 51% of corn acres have reached the dent stage, compared to 5% 1 year ago and 29% normally. 63% of the corn crop was rated in good or excellent condition. Soybeans are virtually all blooming, and 85% of the acres are setting pods, compared to 56% 1 year ago and 79% for the five-year average. Statewide, 64% of the soybean acres were rated in good or excellent condition. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
Mike Barwinski is away, so joining us now with energy analysis is Harry Cooney of GrowMark in Bloomington, Illinois. Good afternoon, Harry.
Well, good afternoon to you, young man. Good afternoon.
took a quick look at the technicals for oil in the last week, and finally a day that was a winner after, what, about five days of declines.
Yeah, you know, we started out the month of August with a real strong market, and we rallied the crude oil from about 78 up to 83 there real fast, stayed there for about a few days, and then last week, almost every day, down, 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 Dave. It just dropped like a rock, and you're right, we'd been down even yesterday, I believe, we closed a little lower, kind of started to run out of some of that downside momentum, and a lot of times whatever happens in the energy markets on Monday turns around during the trade on Tuesday. They call it the turnaround Tuesday effect. It started out as kind of a joke, but anymore it kind of works. So if it closes lower on Monday, you can almost expect energy prices to be higher on Tuesday, and that's kind of what we had here today, just a small rebound bounce.
What do you look for energy prices to do into the next quarter?
Well, I think what happened last week puts us on guard for eventually weaker prices into the late fall. But I think there could be another pop in price, may not go very far, but another pop here over the next month or so at some point, and then it again rolls back over again. So again, I think from these levels you try to rally some, but it doesn't go too far. Eventually you could soften up considerably into late fall and winter. Now that's very important though, because as we're getting ready for the 2011 year, we need to start looking for those opportunities. Hopefully we can get this market to take a big dip, usually around Thanksgiving to Christmas, and then we look at contracting fuel for the first part of 2011, and sometimes if we can get some real good buys, we'll buy all the way out for the rest of the year. So again, we'll be looking for those opportunities. Right now we don't feel there's a lot of opportunities out there. I thought a week ago or so we were ready to take off, and then that kind of fell apart. So right now I think we're going to stay with some choppy trade, hope for that big dip in late fall for next year.
Like to see a little bit of a pickup, I suppose, if you're an energy bull in demand. Usually in the summer, U.S. gasoline demand peaks, but stocks this summer have risen.
Stocks this summer have risen because there was a strong increase in demand for diesel fuel there in early summer, and then about mid-June, that demand for diesel started fading out, and now we're back to double-digit losses under the five-year average in diesel demand. But gasoline demand is almost right up at the five-year average, and from here, this is about the peak in gasoline demand, because on a four-week average, from here on, you start tailing gasoline demand off, because Mommy and Daddy and Billy and Bobby have pretty much had their vacations for the summer, and Billy and Bobby got to go back to school now. So, to put it in a nutshell, demand starts to tail off in gas, and you would think that this diesel demand would start bottoming out down in here, but maybe that just shows how this economy is not quite as strong as what some of us had thought that it would have been, and thus we've seen the stock market back off here in the past week also from, what, about 10,700 down to about 10,003 or so here in the past week there.
Just 20 seconds left, Harry. Is ethanol profitable at the moment?
I don't know. I don't follow the ethanol profitabilities. We just watch the gasoline, diesel fuel, and propane markets in our area. Other people in the company work with the ethanol. Okay. I'm just not as close to that one.
Thank you, Harry.
Thank you, Dave.
That's Harry Cooney of Grillmark in Bloomington, Illinois. In 2 minutes, I'll be back with a look at the agricultural weather. It's National Vanilla Custard Day. Vanilla was originally cultivated in the New World. The Spanish brought vanilla pods to Europe in the 1520s, but the effort proved unsuccessful. Little did the conquistadors know that it was a New World species of bee that pollinated the vanilla orchid. It was not until 1841 that it was discovered that the vanilla bean could be hand-pollinated, leading to the eventual global cultivation of the plant. It's also St. Mammoth's Day, patron of shepherds. On this day in agricultural history, the balloon is celebrated. In 1859, the first airmail in the U.S. took off from Lafayette, Indiana, in a balloon. 119 years later, in 1978, the balloon Double Eagle II completed the first crossing of the Atlantic Ocean by balloon. The 3,100-mile flight took 6 days. The underside of the gondola was a twin-hulled catamaran in case the three-man team had to bail out over water. In 1906, Rutgers and the New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station teamed up to hold the first Ag Field Day to let farmers become better acquainted with experiments that could benefit them. And in 1986, a bronze statue of a pig was dedicated at Seattle's Pike Place Market. And that's this day in agricultural history. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Good afternoon, Josh.
Good afternoon, Dave. How are you?
I am doing well. Thank you, sir. We're in a line for a little bit of a warming trend. It was such a beautiful day or two in the last couple of days.
It is, and you know, we have to say today that today will likely be the first day at Chicago O'Hare up here in Chicago that we won't see 80 degrees. It's been 46 days since we haven't seen 80-degree day here, and that's the longest streak of consecutive days above 80 degrees in Chicago's history, 46 in a row. The previous record is 42, set back in 1955, and you look at temperatures on the hour across much of the state of Illinois, and the story is the same. It's some of the coolest temperatures we've seen in over a month and a half. Peoria here on the hour is only 71 degrees, Bloomington 77, and certainly a cooler trend. And you're right, Dave, that does not last for much longer. We start the warm-up actually tomorrow, and as we get towards the weekend, we bring the southerly flow back in with more humidity, and then that pattern looks to persist much of next week. And you look at precipitation over the state of Illinois and portions of the Midwest here the past 30 days. East central Illinois is certainly mounting some rather serious precipitation deficits on a 30-day total here, less than 35%. And that part of the belt looks dry here again for the next 10 days. The only rainfall chances on Saturday, and that looks to stay more west into Iowa, maybe far northwestern Illinois, and then, as has been the theme the past month, that dies out as it pushes east. So for crops in the east central portions of Illinois, not very good news. They could use that rain to fill out the bean crop.
So it continues to be a case of haves and have-nots this summer.
Absolutely. A feast and famine, if you will. Where it's been wet, man, they just don't need any more rain. And where they haven't had the rain, could really use it. So it's been quite a dynamic summer with the temperatures. We've had, you know, probably the warmest minimum temperatures in all of our lifetimes here across the Midwest this summer. But it's been either very wet or rather dry, and not much of in between.
Someone joked last night at our Outlook panel meeting over in New Ross, Indiana. They said, yeah, it was sort of a wise crack. He said, yeah, and now we'll be talking about an early frost.
Well, yeah, well, luckily with La Nina, there's only so much you could say here on August 17th, but with La Nina, generally that promotes lengthier autumns before your first freeze, all other things equal. So hopefully that's not the case.
About 30 seconds left. What else are you looking at?
Well, of course, Russia continues to be the big story on the global scene, where some model guidance is actually starting to project some of the first rains in the Russia grain belt in over 30 days, actually over 60 days in some areas. We would tend to side against that type of model guidance. We think the dry bias continues here through month's end.
Thank you very much, Josh.
Thanks, Dave.
That's Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. And you've been listening to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willag.org, stay tuned for the farming world. This is Dave Dickey.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll have a discussion with Audrey Erickson. She is the president of the Corn Refiners Association and located in Washington, D.C. Ms. Erickson, thank you so much for being with us. Can you tell me a bit about the Corn Refiners Association and what it might be?
Absolutely. The Corn Refiners Association represents the corn wet milling industry, and our members make many, many ingredients that American consumers enjoy and use every day in a myriad of products, everything from refined corn products found in foods and beverages, in industrial products, in pharmaceuticals, in the paper industry, everything from toothpaste to crayon. There's always a little bit of corn in many of the things that make life possible.
How's that possible?
And what we do is we refine the corn through a wet milling process, meaning that when the kernels enter our plants, of which there are approximately 24 plants across the country, they're steeped in water so that they expand somewhat like a sponge. Then we pull apart the component parts of the kernel and manufacture everything from corn oil to high fructose corn syrup to biodegradable plastics to ethanol. So, and the starches, of course, that we extract from the kernel itself for many uses.
And who are the members, and do they pay a fee to the association?
This is an association that will soon celebrate its 100th anniversary. And our members, there are seven as members of the association, because as you can imagine, this is an industry that is very capital intensive and also has been around for a long time. So you have a lot of players that have been in the business for decades, many decades, some even over 100 years themselves. And all of them are listed on corn.org, which is our website.
And they would be, and I'm going to make some guesses very quickly, probably ADM and Bungie, I would suppose. Cargill?
Actually, I'll name them alphabetically for you, and it is Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill Incorporated, Corn Products International, National Starch, Penford Products, Roquette America, and Tate & Lyle.
Ah, so some that our listeners will be familiar with, of course, and some that our listeners are not. What's the difference between a wet mill and a dry mill? And maybe you can talk about the ethanol industry in that process.
Sure. Really, with respect to both, it's all about the process, about how you either, in the case of a dry mill, crush the corn in essence, or mill the corn, or in a wet mill where you are steeping it in water. You get far more products from a wet milling operation than from a dry mill. And dry mill, you know, there's the dry mills that make corn flour and corn meal, and then there's also the dry mills that make ethanol and dried distiller's grains. On our side, for wet milling, you're making all the various corn starches, both modified and unmodified, the specialty starches. You're making corn sweeteners like high fructose corn syrup and corn syrup and fructose, so the fructose and glucose syrups. You're making PLA, polylactic acid, you know, which is the plastics. you're making the animal feed, which is corn gluten feed and corn gluten meal. So, and then a whole host of other products.
And so what do you do for these companies exactly? Do you lobby on behalf of them in Washington? Is that why you're located there?
Yes, we are located in Washington in part because we work closely with the administration, both the executive branch, but also the legislative branch, members of Congress, naturally the House and the Senate, when there are issues affecting our industry. Let's take, in the case when we are negotiating trade agreements with other countries, we're working hard with the administrative branch, for example, to ensure that our products are in the lowest tariff baskets. We're working with Congress to get the passage of those trade agreements, just as an example. We also work closely with the press and provide information to them about the products from our industry. And you may have heard, for example, we're working very hard on a public education campaign for our corn sweetener high fructose corn syrup, essentially to correct the record in the public domain.
So you're up to those things at this point. You have 100 years of history. How did you come into being?
Really, it was an organization that started largely as an institute, had a primary function, many functions, but one of which way back when was research in the industry as new and innovative uses of corn were being developed. And over time, that has really changed to today, where research is conducted largely by our member companies themselves, and the job of the association is more along the lines of public information and advocacy.
Okay. Can you talk about one of the subjects I know that you're, I'm sure, well-versed with? This would be high fructose corn syrup. It's come under a lot of pressure for childhood obesity in recent years. What do the numbers look like, do you think, from the perspective of the producers of high fructose corn syrup, and how does it get incorporated into the food supply?
Well, high fructose corn syrup is a substitute for sugar. It's a type of sugar made from corn. It was introduced into the U.S. market widely in the late 70s, and by mid to late 80s became the sweetener of preference, if you will, for caloric soft drinks, and then branched into many, many food uses because of its characteristics, everything from retaining moisture in baked goods to bringing out fruit and spice flavors and marinades to aiding in fermentation of yogurt to having a lower freezing point. So when you have products that are stored in the freezer, when you pull them out, you know, they look like a strawberry, or when they're canned, for example, helping retain the firmness of that particular fruit or vegetable, has a myriad of uses and is widely prized by the food and beverage industry, and as a result is about just under half the caloric sweetener use in America, with table sugar being the predominant use of caloric sweeteners. And there has been, just in recent years, a lot of misinformation about the product, largely because it has two words in its name, high and fructose, when in fact it's an ingredient that is neither of those. It's not high in fructose at all. In fact, it's very similar to table sugar or honey or maple syrup in that it contains almost equal parts of the two simple sugars, fructose and glucose. And at the same time that you have the issue of obesity being discussed as a public health issue, and then you have a lot of researchers who are trying to find the holy grail key. Is there something unique, you know, that causes obesity when something else doesn't? Well, guess what? We always know the answer to that, and that is calories in and calories out remains the primary equation when it comes to overweight and obese conditions in America. And in fact, that issue, obesity and overweight conditions, is not immune to just the United States. It's not only here, but it's worldwide, yet this is a sweetener that is predominantly found only in the United States. Because corn is our primary starch source, and we grow well here, obviously, whereas other countries have highly protected sugar industries, for example, and so sugar remains their primary caloric sweetener. So we've been working hard in our campaign to provide the science-based facts, because ultimately when consumers come to their diet and nutrition needs, they need to know what it is and what it ain't, as some people would say. They need to know the facts about the foods that they and their families eat. And so that's largely what our campaign is designed to do, is to provide information to consumers so that they can make sound dietary decisions.
And primarily, most people would think of this being used for colas and soft drinks in the United States. But if you travel out of the United States, you'll find that many of those are actually developed with sugar, cane sugar, as opposed to that which would come from corn. Is this correct?
That is correct, and that is largely because of the sugar policies that many countries around the world have, whether they're protecting their own domestic supply or whether they are favoring, if you will, through agricultural policy, imports from countries that are lesser developed. As you know, sugar is grown in many countries around the world. The majority of countries that grow sugar are lesser developed or least developed nations. And so you have regions of the world like the European Union that have policies that favor trade with those countries. In the United States, we have both sugar produced domestically as well as the sweetener, the sugar from corn, high fructose corn syrup.
Now, in the United States, wouldn't you say that, and maybe I'm wrong, the agricultural policies of the United States favors high fructose corn sweeteners rather than sugar?
Well, it's interesting. I'm glad you asked the question. It's a very good one. In fact, there are only really two sweeteners that benefit from the Farm Bill directly, and that would be sugar. You know, we have a policy in the United States which is limit imports, keep them at zero if possible. That's just the policy that's been adopted. And then for the domestic supply of sugar, that it's regulated. Its entire supply is regulated by the U.S. Department of Agriculture in terms of which a refiner of sugar can put refined sugar on the market, whether it comes from beets, sugar beets, or sugar cane. Conversely, on the corn side of the equation, high fructose corn syrup is not in the Farm Bill. It is a highly competitive product produced by five manufacturers in the United States that compete in the U.S. market, not only against each other, but clearly against other caloric sweeteners in the marketplace, from honey to maple syrup to sugar to fruit juice concentrates, which are just stripped down to their sugar components. And policies in the Farm Bill, which, you know, affect row crops and attempt to support their price, if you will. In the case of corn, that's not been needed in the past several years because demand for corn has been robust and the price of corn has been strong, historically above average in these most recent years.
Yeah, but it's the policy for sugar that helps out the corn refiners and allows fructose to continue to be used in part, I suppose, in the production of soft drinks.
Well, actually, that's a great question. And when it comes to the policies of sugar, clearly, you know, there is a policy in the United States. The net effect of the policy in the United States is to maintain a very high price for sugar, but it's the sugar industry that doesn't want competition. But yet, when it comes to high fructose corn syrup, the pricing of our ingredient is delinked. Has been for, what, two decades now from sugar. When we first introduced this ingredient into the marketplace, it was the case that it was essentially priced, if you will, at some discount to sugar. That once we supplied 100% of the caloric needs for, you know, full calorie soft drinks, that price delinkage began, in essence, and it has accelerated through time, and a lot of the data would demonstrate that. But yet, what really drives the demand for high fructose corn syrup is its functionality. And by that, I mean in the case of soft drinks, when you put it in a pH environment like a soft drink, it won't change its taste profile over time. It will remain intact. Unlike sugar, which the two simple sugars will slowly separate, and as that happens, it would change its taste profile, which, as you know, for these branded beverages, that is something that is not tolerable. Also, this is a sweetener that's provided in liquid form, easy to blend. And because of where we taste on the tongue, it won't mask certain flavors. So if you have a lemon-lime beverage, for example, you're going to enhance those lemon-lime flavors rather than mask them, which sugar can tend to do. But these functional benefits are really pervasive throughout the many uses of high fructose corn syrup, whether it's in yogurts or breads or cereals or crackers or salad dressings or spaghetti sauce or condiments, you name it, of the many uses in which we find high fructose corn syrup, what really drives the demand for this ingredient is those functional benefits that make many of these foods possible that we consumers, you know, take for granted but enjoy on a daily basis.
We're talking today with Audrey Erickson. She's the president of the Corn Refiners Association. You're listening to The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. More in a moment.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, China's Commerce Ministry today says it is working with Argentina on a mechanism to help resolve a trade dispute over soy oil, but gave no time frame for the resumption of soy oil imports from the world's largest exporter. China has suspended soy oil imports from Argentina, citing quality problems in retaliation for Argentina's imposing anti-dumping duties on a range of Chinese goods. Meanwhile, Oil World Today says that Argentina's soy oil exports continue to rise. Oil exports in July rose to 570,000 tons, up 41% on the year. Argentina boosted soy oil exports to India and also shipped larger quantities to South Korea, other Asian countries, the EU, and several African countries. Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan says its board has received and rejected an unsolicited takeover bid from BHP Petillon Limited worth about $38.49 billion, saying it undervalues the fertilizer producer. BHP Petillon, an Australian natural resources company, is offering to buy Potash, a fertilizer company, for $130 a share. That's a 16% premium over Monday's closing price. The Federal Reserve on Monday published new rules aimed at protecting consumers from abusive mortgage practices, including clearer cost disclosures and a ban on payments to mortgage brokers for steering borrowers into loans with higher interest rates. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Today, we're talking with Audre Erickson. She's the president of the Corn Refiners Association. We had discussed in great detail some of the high fructose sugar, but it's time to switch topics, Ms. Erickson, maybe to talk about some of the other products. Can you tell me what's made from corn and the kinds of exports that we have from the United States?
Well, we export about $1.5 billion worth of product. A lot of that has been animal feed products, historically to the European Union, but biotech policies in the EU have not kept pace with technology in the United States, and biotechnology in particular, in corn traits. So we've seen that those exports move to other countries. We also export a fair amount of corn oil and corn starch. And recently, exports of high fructose corn syrup to Mexico have regained momentum because we've resolved a long-standing NAFTA dispute.
What's the position of the Refiners Association on the availability of corn to produce both fuel, food, feed, and all the types of things that corn is used for in the U.S. domestically and internationally?
Well, as you can imagine, we're strong supporters of all uses of corn, and believe that there's sufficient corn supply for those many uses. Clearly, as we increase yields of corn, that further enhances that situation that there's enough corn to go around. And, you know, we are an industry that uses corn to refine it into products for both food uses, clearly for fuel, because our members do make ethanol from the wet milling process. But we make many of the ingredients that also go into pharmaceuticals, you know, whether it's an IV solution when someone's in the hospital or it's timed-release gel caps. You know, they find their start with corn. So we believe that there are many uses and will continue to be from the U.S. supply.
Do you have a position on the 2012 Farm Bill yet?
No, and, you know, interestingly, our association is not one that works hard on the Farm Bill. You'll be surprised because the many ingredients we make, we're going to make whether or not there's a Farm Bill, and the components of that Farm Bill really don't affect our supply and demand conditions. You know, we're supportive of a strong agricultural economy and an environment that's conducive to the continued cultivation of corn and other commodities here in America, obviously, but it just so happens that the elements of the Farm Bill are not ones that directly affect us, by and large. Naturally, you know, there are sometimes you know, pilot programs or something that might have to do with renewable sources, or, you know, that you'll find that we as an industry support, or, you know, when dollars are put, and mind you, they have been minimal heretofore, but dollars are invested in promoting trade. Although we are not a beneficiary industry of some of those programs that are established, we're supportive of increasing trade with other countries.
How did genetic modification of the corn plant cause the refiner's problems? And do you think there are still export issues that might come up? And I'm making some assumptions in the second part of the question.
Well, largely our issues in biotech, which, by the way, of course, we're very strong supporters of biotechnology and applaud new traits that are being introduced annually by the many seed tech providers. But when it comes to biotech, the biggest challenge we've really had is with the European Union because, as you know, they have been slow and often reluctant to accept the technology for political reasons, and politics trumps science when it comes to European Union and their agricultural and food policies. So as a result, we have seen a dramatic drop-off of exports of our corn gluten feed. So here as a nation, we don't export corn to the European Union because of their biotech policies, but we have been exporting corn gluten feed even during periods when corn wasn't exported because Europe is, you know, a region of the world that grows a lot of livestock, needs the protein to foster that livestock production, and corn gluten feed is clearly one of the highest quality protein-containing feed options available. But because so many new traits were being introduced in the United States, that affected our ability to export corn gluten feed to the European Union. Currently, all of the traits that have been introduced in the United States as single varieties, not the stack, but the single varieties are now approved for use in Europe, but by that I mean use presence in foods and stuff, not necessarily cultivation. As a result, we expect our corn gluten feed exports to increase somewhat for a short period of time until new traits are commercially available in the U.S.
Audrey Erickson is the president of the Corn Refiners Association. We've been talking with her here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On behalf of Dave Dickey, I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.
Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. We have two more Agricultural Outlook panels this week. Tomorrow evening, that's August 18th, we'll be at the Shelby County Senior Center in Shelbyville, Illinois, with a dinner that begins at 6 o'clock and the panel to follow. Panelists for Wednesday's meeting include Matt Bennett of Total Grain Marketing, Pete Manhart of Bates Commodities, Sherman Newland of Risk Management Commodities, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. And then on Thursday, August 19th, we'll be at the El Paso Golf Course Clubhouse in El Paso, Illinois. Again, with a dinner at 6 o'clock and the meeting to follow shortly thereafter. Panelists on Thursday night is Jackie Vakes of Stuart Peterson Group, Mike Zuzalo of Global Commodity Analytics, and Bill Mayer of Strategic Farm Marketing. The meetings are free. We hope to see you there.